the hearing in docket TC07-HP07-001 is reconvened following our noon recess. On the stand is John Muehlhausen. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes.
And we, I think, had concluded Rod Tobin's cross-examination. I kind of put the squeeze on you there. If you have any additional questions, I'd certainly allow you to proceed.
I think anything additional I can do at.
Okay.
Later.
Later on. Okay. Mr. Hone, questions for Mr. Muehlhausen?
In your exchange with applicants' attorneys regarding roads, as good as or better than the original road, do you recall that conversation?
Yes.
If a township road had to be built up so that the project could be constructed and it was left in a better condition, that would also be useful for emergency response, would it not? In the future?
That seems logical.
Okay. On page one of your testimony, your degree is in anthropology?
Yes.
And could you summarize essentially what that studies?
Anthropology is the study of basically human behavior. There are a variety of it's a social science is what it is, and there are a variety of social sciences. we study culture, societies, and we study it through a variety of ways. It's actually a very broad field. It can include forensic anthropology, which is sort of pathology. It can include cultural anthropology, ethnography. It can include archaeology. It can include, in some cases, linguistics. So it's just a very, very broad category of the study of human societies and cultures.
Okay, thank you. On page 4, line 19, the proposed pipeline would affect approximately 2,169 acres of crop land. Is that referring to the easement area impact, page 4, line 19?
That, line 19.
Yes.
That's referring to a number that I took, I believe it was, from the EIS, and what they had determined, the number of acres of cropland that would be affected in the state. It might have been from a different source. I don't recall the specific source. I did not calculate it.
But given the that number, is it fair to say that it's referring to the crop ground crossed by the pipe and not the adjacent property on either side?
It would be the area affected, directly affected by construction. It might include the construction right away, extra workspaces,
sure,
things like that.
We had testimony from previous witnesses, farmers and landowners, saying that during construction, some of their land might be isolated. This number would not take into account that isolated property, would it?
My understanding of the number is that it would not take that into account.
Okay, thank you. On page 6 of your direct testimony, lines 15 and 16, do you see that there?
Yep.
the river you're referring to in that sentence is the Missouri River, is that right?
That's correct.
Did you take into account adverse impacts the project might have on the James River and associated recreation?
No. The only the purpose of this discussion of the Missouri River is that it actually has a recreational, an official recreational designation.
And by saying official recreational designation, that wouldn't diminish recreation on the James River, in your opinion, would it?
No.
Okay. On page 7, lines 6 through 7, refers to commercial and industrial developed land. Are you familiar with the reroute of the pipeline in the Yankton area near the Missouri River, the recent reroute?
No, I'm not.
So if that reroute affected industrial, that wouldn't be reflected in this statement?
No, I based this analysis on the maps and information provided in the application. If there has been subsequent routing or information provided since then, I haven't received it.
Okay, thank you. Page 8, line 14 through 18, deals with compensation to landowners. The compensation you're referring to is for this, the pipe in this application. Is that right?
And I think that compensation to landowners, if we're going to get specific, is part of the motion in limine that was subject earlier.
It is, unless I'll overrule only to the extent that what you're getting at is general questions about the what his this Mr. Muehlhausen's testimony is using as its assumptions.
Yes, it's not as specific. It's as to the general nature in this document.
Oh, that's fine.
Your testimony here as to landowner compensation does not cover possible future pipes that might be put in this corridor, does it?
I don't know how TransCanada is negotiating their easement, if it's single line or multiple line, so I can't answer that.
One of the documents submitted as part of Webb's testimony is a copy of the first easement presented to landowners through the pipeline route area, which made reference to one or more pipelines. And that easement has been secured, it's our understanding, from landowners. In that event, would lines 14 through 17 be referring to compensation for one pipe or more pipes?
I'll object, first of all, we don't know if our witness is familiar with that document. And second, we're here in this hearing to look at the application, and the application is submitted by TransCanada for one pipeline.
Sustained.
In his testimony at this hearing, Mr. Jones said that if there was an opportunity to place two more pipes in this right-of-way, and he would like the opportunity, his company would, to be able to utilize that for two more pipes if the need arose. I would think that's foundation for this question then.
Same objection. We don't know how familiar this witness is with that testimony, the easement documents, and we are here examining the application as submitted by TransCanada for one pipeline.
Yeah, additionally, I think it's a misstatement of the record.
Well, I think it is, too. But besides that, we're not adjudicating, individual land. If TransCanada wants to buy their whole darn farm, they're perfectly free to do that. to me that it's just not what we're here about. We're here about this particular project, which is the pipeline.
Okay, I'll move along. Page 9, line 18 through 23 refers to law enforcement and anticipated needs once the construction is undertaken. Is that right?
Yes.
In making your, you gathered a lot of data, I assume, to research this section.
Yes.
Did you look to information on this issue during the construction of other pipelines in the Midwest or in South Dakota?
I did.
And did you look to the impacts to the South Dakota during the construction of the Northern Border Pipeline?
No.
Page 14 of your testimony, lines 4 through 7, refers to two bonds, a $3 million bond in 2008 and a $12 million bond in 2009. Why is the number different for the 2 years?
What page was that?
I'm showing page 14, unless I'm off. Page 14 and then lines 4 through 7, do you see that?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know why the difference in the bond might be between 08 and 09?
The I'm just trying to recall here. You know, off the top of my head, I can't recall. I do remember that there was some logic to it. I would need to look into that.
Okay, thank you. And based on your review of this, these bonds, would they cover township roads as well as county?
This is a bond that is required by state law for the PUC. I am not exactly sure what it covers.
Okay. It references public roads, and the assumption would be that township and county would be public.
Yeah.
But you don't know for sure.
I don't know exactly what it covers. No.
Fine. On page 14 again, still, lines 13 through 14 make reference to the state collection of $18 million from construction in sales and excise tax. Was that based on $300 million worth of construction or $500?
$300.
Okay. Since you learned that the construction cost appears to have been increased to $500, have you had an opportunity to recalculate that?
I do believe the expert testified that he has not, and recalculation may not prove to be a benefit.
Well, I think this has all been asked and answered already.
And the answer is no, he hasn't calculated it?
It's been asked and answered. It'll be in the record.
Yes, that is what he said. And it was gone over quite thoroughly.
So if I'm reading line 14 correct, line 17 and 18, TransCanada is eligible for a waiver of that tax. Are you aware of whether they've applied for that?
I have no idea.
You may have stated this before, but I don't recall this answer. Was the source of your information, or was your information that you gathered reviewed with the Department of Revenue? The tax information.
That was asked and answered, I believe.
Could you restate it for me?
Go ahead and restate it. Yes, it was. He's already answered that. But.
And I'm not sure exactly which information you're specifically referring to, but as far as I know, I did not provide this report to them. I don't know whether or not they've been interested in this proceeding and obtained a copy of it.
But you weren't in contact with them?
No.
Okay. I'd like to turn to your report, the larger report, the social economic assessment, October 19. On page 14, you have a table 5 showing economic impact. And on the top of that page would be page 14.
Are you sure you got the right page?
Maybe I've got. I must have an earlier report. Was this resubmitted?
No. I don't know where you would got a copy dated October 19th, but that would be correct.
Yeah, I was going to say our final version is October 29, is the one that's part of the record.
I have one 29 and one 19. I'm not sure how I got it. I would have got it off the website, I think.
I don't believe it's filed.
Okay, so we should be referring to the 29th. I'll correct myself here. Thank you. On table 5, which is on page 19, economic impact of the Keystone Pipeline Project. Is TransCanada planning to spend $11 million annually in the project area? Is that what that's showing?
This table doesn't show what they're planning on spending annually in the project area.
Yeah. Apparently the 19th report, which must have been a draft, showed $11 million was going to be spending annually, and it's not in the one that's been filed.
I'll argue it's irrelevant. The final version is filed and part of the record. It is the exhibit we're looking at, and any draft is irrelevant, regardless of how it was obtained, which I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. That's not
all right. We'll move along
in
then.
The record anyway. That is testimony.
It's on page 17, second paragraph, referencing TransCanada's planning on spending about $11 million annually in the project area for operation of the pipeline. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Where would that number have came from?
From TransCanada in a data request.
And was it broken down as to where the $11 million?
I did not ask them to break it down except into the way I asked the questions was in terms of electricity and then everything else.
And as shown in Table 4, the bulk of that $11 million would be the $10 million electricity, correct?
That's correct.
Thanks. Did your social economic study look at or address the issue of the economic impact of a major spill?
Not specifically, no.
And is it possible to estimate the economic impact of a major spill on a community or on the state?
I suppose somebody could estimate that.
Were you asked to address that issue in your testimony?
No, I wasn't specifically asked to.
Okay. I believe that's all the questions, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Commissioner, questions?
Good afternoon, Mr. Muehlhausen. Hi.
Good afternoon.
On page 25 of your report, and I'm looking at the end of the second paragraph on page 25, you note that in at least one study, there were findings that the location of a pipeline had no significant impact on the sales price or demand for properties located along that right-of-way. Is that a fair summary of that area?
That's correct.
In your professional experience, have you come across studies that had a finding counter to that one?
This is the only specific study that addresses pipeline impacts on home values that I'm aware of.
Did you review the methodologies used by the study at all?
I did not specifically review the methodologies. I did obtain a copy of the study, and I disclosed in my report here the fact that it was prepared by the Interstate Natural Gas Association of America, which is an industry side.
Did in your evaluation of the study, did it appear that the methodologies were sound?
Well, certainly, yes.
Okay. Similarly, I have similar questions with regard to, on page 10 of your testimony, I know you make reference to historical data and the negligible effect on local crime rates. And again, that's a summary. If that's incorrect, please correct me.
That's correct.
A paraphrase, rather. That was a Department of it's a Department of Justice analysis. Have you encountered in your professional experience any studies or information that have findings that run contrary to those you listed?
No. And actually, the analysis was based on my obtaining raw data and taking a look at it. I obtained raw data from the Department of Justice. And simply looked at the crime rate trends over those years for those counties directly affected by that project.
So I can presume then that you think the methodology was not only sound but brilliant.
It absolutely was.
That's all I've got right now, Mr. Smith. Thanks. Thank you.
I forgot who it was over there. Was it? Oh, wait a minute. We got to go back to staff. Pardon me. Commissioner Colbeck.
Thank you for being here. Could you tell me the exact footage? When you and Mr. Kennecke were jousting there, I was still confused when the joust was over there. Could you tell me the exact footage for siting near homes that you're recommending?
Okay, I'm not recommending a specific footage,
okay.
And I want to apologize. I wasn't trying to be sort of controversial or negative. I just simply was having a hard time understanding.
Well, he's kind of a softy, so. No problem. So there's really no...
That's correct. I think it needs to be looked at on a site-specific case.
Okay. Do I understand that your testimony that TransCanada would be in control of the quality of the road restoration?
TransCanada would be required to ensure that the roads would be restored to their pre-construction condition.
Okay.
Or better.
And what role would you think that the counties would play in that, the highway superintendent or the county superintendent?
Based on my experience, typically if there's a problem, the county road commissions let them know. In fact, frequently there's close coordination between pipeline contractors and the road commissions because of permitting road crossings and many other things, and deterioration such as this. And that is one of those maybe processes that hasn't seemed, in my opinion, to need formalization.
Okay. The county commission still controls the roads, correct, and how they're going to be fixed?
That's correct.
Okay. And according to the value, and the economic side of that, the value and the property taxes that were being discussed, could you explain to me why my home taxes always go up, but yet your pipeline is actually on book value, which is going down?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things I want to say regarding this. One, I am not a tax expert, so this is pushing sort of the edge for me. And
I do want to interrupt, and if I'm wrong, please somebody else correct me, but I think, Commissioner, that may be an incorrect presumption. I don't know that we have on the record information that indicates the taxation on a pipeline is based on book value as opposed to real value.
No, not book value, but the taxes are being figured accordingly more on a book value, whereas they're going down. Valuation is going down, whereas some other properties, the valuation goes up.
It may, in fact, not go down. It will depend on your county commissioners and how they do value the pipe. That is entirely up to them in accordance with state law.
Okay.
And that
valuation may go up if the price of crude oil were to go up so that the commodity or the pipe could be worth more, or?
That I can't answer. I just don't know.
So there's nothing definite on taxation in the future. It could go either way. Is that what you're saying?
This
is probably not a fair question after you said you're not a tax expert.
So my understanding is that it could.
It could. Okay. That's all I have.
Commissioner Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Good afternoon, Mr. Mühlhausen.
Good afternoon.
My questions are going to confine themselves to just page 3 and 4 of your testimony, your direct testimony. On line 3 of page 4, you state that during operation of the pipeline, for every dollar spent in South Dakota by TransCanada, an additional 33 cents of indirect and induced output would be expected in South Dakota. That sort of flies in the face of a lot of the statements that are made by promoters of developments when they say that the money will turn over 6 times or 7 times, things of that nature. And you start to smile when I say that. You've obviously heard that before. Can you balance where those two are? Is it, well, rather than me asking?
Well,
yeah,
I'm
question.
Not trying to promote real estate to you. What we do when we do an input-output analysis, and one of the things I try to do is keep it very simple. And one way to keep it very simple is to purchase these multipliers In other words, this would amount to a multiplier of 1.3. We purchased them from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. This is a number that's specifically for the counties crossed, collectively added together, that the Bureau of Economic Analysis has said, if you're going to increase demand for pipeline transportation needs in the state, this is what your multiplier would be. So it's something that the Bureau of Economic Analysis puts together and is not something that I put together. Does that answer your question?
It tells me where you arrived at your figures. Perhaps I need to find out where the other persons obtained their figures.
Right.
As opposed to trying to figure out how the two balance, since you don't have any idea of where they're obtaining their numbers.
And generally, the larger your area that you're looking at, the bigger your multiplier is going to be. The smaller your area that you're looking at, the smaller your multiplier is going to be. And there are just a variety of variables and factors that they consider when putting these multipliers together, and it's a very complicated process that I personally could not do myself, but the fact that they're available from the federal government is a good thing. It allows maybe simpler economic analysis.
And one would assume at least a neutral third party as opposed to someone else coming up with the number. About midway on that page 4, on line 12, you speak of that fact, according to that during operations, 61 direct and indirect jobs could be created. And over on page 3, line 16, you state that Keystone would hire 3 employees locally to support operation. Is the 61 number for the entire pipeline?
No. The 61 includes the 3 people plus an additional 58. They provide the federal government provides multipliers for employment also. But due to spending that $11 million per year in South Dakota to operate the pipeline, mostly for electricity, but that's going to have what's called the ripple effect in the economy. It's going to create jobs. So it's going to create an additional 58 jobs indirectly as a result of operating the pipeline. So Keystone is proposing to have 3 employees, and then these indirect or induced jobs would result in, according to the multipliers, 58.
Thank you. And the I'm going to assume, and perhaps I shouldn't assume, that multiplier then takes into consideration the effect of the $11 million on how many direct and indirect, and then how many direct and indirect, how many direct.
That is exactly it. That you've hit it on the nose. It is a sum of an infinite series.
Thank you. The I understand the last, almost understand, the last sentence in that paragraph on page 4 that starts on line 14. I have a little challenge with the last part that states, and labor costs in the industries most affected by the project are less than one-third the revenues. Could you tell me
what that means?
Clarify that for me, please?
Sure. In trying to determine whether or not an economic impact is beneficial or not, you need to look at how much money it's bringing in and then subtract the cost of bringing raising those revenues. So if your costs of obtaining those revenues exceed the actual revenues, that's a bad thing. Labor is it is sort of the concept that profit is equal to revenues minus cost of goods sold, which would include labor. minus overhead. And in that sense, when you have lower labor costs, they don't have as much potential to reduce sort of the earnings of those revenues. You have essentially, I guess, to put it sort of in lay terms, more profit.
But when you speak of the labor costs are less than one-third of the revenues from where? From
well, just revenues in the industry in general. The federal government tracks the revenues generated for just, you know, a variety of industries. Like you could go through the SIC codes or the NIASC codes, I think they are, and they track income or revenues by all those. They track cost of labor.
Okay. Thank you. Do you know, in your analysis, of any adverse economic impact from this pipeline?
I had mentioned...
other than what you had gone over previously?
No. Typically, my experience has been in doing these types of analyses that the economic impacts are typically, you know, beneficial, and it's, in a way, it's one of the nicer things to study and do analyses on, because you're not always talking about negative impacts where, you know, with environmental issues and things like that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Commissioner Kohlbeck?
Yeah, I'm sorry, questions. I forgot one. On page 17 of your report, not on your direct testimony, but on your assessment, social and economic, that electricity, that $10,100,000 that's stated there, are you familiar with the co-op model and how that works?
In this state, no.
A cooperative.
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with the model in general, yeah.
Were dividends through a co-op figured into the economic status?
I did not do that, no.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Kanicki?
You have some questions?
Yeah. Wait a minute, did I give staff a chance here? I've lost track.
No.
I'm sorry.
Well, that's fine.
I'm kind of...
Aside from the clarification you made that you are not an accountant and you're not a tax attorney, did you have any other clarifications or corrections to make regarding statements you made previously on the
record?
Yeah,
I was I think it was Roderick Tobin had asked me a question about the taxes. I actually misstated how the taxes, ad valorem taxes, are collected. And, you know, it's my understanding, based on looking at Department of Revenue and regulation publications, that it's the pipeline will be valued, and then the taxes will be collected. It'll be valued by the state for consistency, but the taxes actually are collected by the counties at a county level. And I think I may have said that backwards. I wasn't sure, but I wanted to clarify that.
I don't have anything further.
Mr. Kanicki.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you, Mr. Muehlhausen. The first thing I'd like to do is ask the Commission to take judicial notice of Chapter 1037 of South Dakota Codified Laws entitled Taxation of Pipeline Companies.
We will certainly do that. It's the law.
Thank you.
So we will attempt to pay attention to that.
Mr. Muehlhausen, did you consult Chapter 10-37 of the South Dakota Code entitled Taxation of Pipeline Companies in the preparation of your reports?
I didn't consult it, no.
Do you recall the questions you've been asked today about depreciation?
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you about that. If you knew that the state law in this section of the code required the pipeline to be valued at fair market value, would that have an impact on your
answers as to depreciation?
Yes.
And if you knew that for the purpose of determining the fair market value of the property, the department shall take into consideration the cost approach, the income approach, and the market approach to valuation, would that also have an effect on your opinion on depreciation?
Yes, it would.
And would it still be your opinion that, or your thought that testimony that depreciation would be a consideration in the valuation of the taxation of the pipeline?
Could you repeat that?
Probably not. If you knew those two things, would you still would it still be your testimony that depreciation was a factor in the property taxation of the pipeline?
No.
Thank you very much.
Any last questions, Mr. Tobin?
Just a couple.
Okay.
With regard to the explanation you just gave regarding the 58 jobs, I believe that came from page 4, line 12 of the testimony. And in light of the fact that $10,100,000 of the operational money will come from basically utility or electricity, can you give an example of where you would anticipate that many jobs being created?
Well, they could be created just in a variety of sectors. What the multipliers take into effect, these employment multipliers, or take into consideration, rather, are everything from these utility companies needing to hire more people, maybe to operate their utilities, to the fact that those people now have more disposable income in the area and maybe, say, go out to dinner more, the need for more jobs for, say, food service. It ripples through absolutely every sector and every industry. And if you, there is a table in there, I believe it's table 5 in the report, that tells you by industry how many jobs that the Bureau of Economic Analysis thinks would be created.
But it would be fair to say that those are estimates at best based on modeling data and in no way necessarily indicative of real-world results.
That is absolutely correct.
Thank you.
I would object that the no way indicative.
Let me correct that.
I don't think.
It's a model.
Okay.
It's an estimate. You're absolutely correct in that it's an estimate and it's a model. What it's not intended to represent is exactly what the future state holds. It you're trying to predict the future, and what you're trying to do is predict it in an educated way based on past information. And that's what they gather. It's essentially actuarial science, I guess, if you will.
Thank you. On page 4, line 12, there was discussion. I'm sorry, page 4, line 3. I believe Commissioner Hansen discussed the additional indirect or induced output would be expected in South Dakota. Can you give me, is that in the same vein as the jobs, or is that different when we talk about $0.33 of indirect or induced output would be expected in South Dakota?
Well, that's in the same vein. I understand your question correctly, these multipliers, they provide for total output, for earnings, and for jobs, and they're essentially applied the same way.
So that $0.33 would be maybe in the form of salaries for these additional people that you're talking about?
It would include that.
Okay. The last sentence of that first full paragraph on page 4 says the largest outputs would be felt by utilities, construction, and transportation and warehousing industries. I understand the utilities in construction, but can you explain the transportation and warehousing industries to me?
Sure. For example, if the if the utility company needed to acquire, say, more equipment and needed to warehouse it, say, for example, and, you know, they had to acquire more wire, more whatever, and they needed to warehouse it. Well, number one, they needed to get it there, and then number two, they needed to warehouse it. Then that increases demand in that industry. Now, that industry is broad and encompasses trucking and, you know, a lot of different things.
Do you know whether the specific utilities in South Dakota that will provide electricity have the capacity or will be required to do any additions to their infrastructure to meet this demand?
Well, let me just say this. I do know that they're going to have to build some new lines to get there, and they're going to have to, I think, build some new substations. So I think the answer, if I understand your question correctly, is, yeah, they're going to have to do some work.
Okay. Final question pertains to your socioeconomic report on page 25. And I believe, again, this was a discussion about valuation. And at the top of that page, it states that an industrial user might find the pipeline preferable. And I believe this is in context of the discussion of land values and why land may actually increase in value, in that an industrial user might find the pipeline preferable. Are you aware of any industrial users that will be able to directly tap into this pipeline?
Nope.
Thank you.
Mr. Hone, any last questions?
Yes, I had a follow-up on page 30 of your testimony.
Of the report?
Yeah, of the, I guess it'd be the report, I'm sorry, page 30. The bottom of that page. Regarding law enforcement, would not expect to be increased dramatically during construction. Did you?
Mr. Hone, will you state that again?
Sure.
Sneeze, I didn't hear your word there.
Absolutely.
Regarding law enforcement, would not expect to be.
That must have been the sneeze right in the middle there. Regarding law enforcement, emergency services would not be expected to increase dramatically during construction. That's the statement. Would you anticipate that it would increase after construction?
No.
Then the bottom portion of that very same paragraph, starting with the words, with crude oil pipelines, however, there is always a concern that a leak or incident during operation would require emergency response.
I believe the question was asked as to law enforcement. I don't know if the answer is any different, but the question was asked as to law enforcement.
It's a second question.
Overruled.
I guess the question is, would you anticipate from an economic social impacts review whether emergency response, firefighting, and so forth might increase because the oil line is running through the state?
I don't, and this is not, you know, obviously I haven't studied that directly or I would have put that here in the report, but I don't have any specific numbers. But my estimation would be that they would not hire new people, but that there might be some additional equipment.
Costs.
I don't think they would be significant.
And as a follow-up to that, are you aware of whether the taxes collected for the pipeline would be available for firefighting?
I don't know.
Okay. Looking to page 32 of that same document, the testimony presented by the applicant was three permanent jobs would be stationed at Yankton and that there might be additional jobs that are part-time. From your economic study, do you know what those part-time jobs might be involved in?
No, I don't necessarily specifically know what they were referring to when they were referring to those part-time jobs.
Is it possible that they would be cleanup, involved in cleanup?
You would have to ask them.
Okay. You, in your testimony at the bottom of page 34, you make reference to the Pipeline Safety Act, Improvement Act of 2002, correct?
I believe we're beyond the scope of redirect. I object.
I apologize. Where were you at, Kurt?
We're at the bottom of page 32 regarding the Pipeline Safety Act of 2002.
And these questions were certain. He could have asked them on direct and didn't. We're now on redirect.
I probably agree with that. Is this getting some, what are we talking about here, jobs or what?
I'm referring to the question relates to the changes in law that affect social and economic issues or impacts.
Well, this is definitely you're beyond what it would be true recross, but ask your question.
That last portion of the paragraph on page 32 at the bottom of the page refers to two incidents. I'm not going to go into the incidents. They're referenced in writing there in front of us. But on the very next page, it estimates that because of the change in law, there is an estimate of between $5 billion and $11 billion in additional cost to the industry over 20 years. Was that something you had available, or did you reference that to another source?
Well, the footnote's right there, and it's referenced to the United States Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration. What that is referring to is the cost to the pipeline companies for getting into compliance with the more stringent regulations.
Is that considered part of your economic assessment?
Well, it's right here.
So it would
it's
be,
in it.
It would
yes.
be counted in part of the assessment. Economic assessment. I guess my question, let me rephrase the question. Is that considered a benefit in your assessment?
It's neither considered a benefit nor a detriment. It's just used as an example, or an illustration of costs.
Okay. Thank you. I believe that's it, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. If there are no other commissioner questions, I'm going to, unless I hear a loud outcry, I'm going to excuse the witness. You're excused. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Staff, now calls Tom Jansen, please.
raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Jansen, please state your name, business address, and employer for the record.
My name is Tom Jansen. My business address is 615 First Avenue Northeast, Suite 425, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55413. I work at Mergent Incorporated.
Please state your educational background.
I received a BA from the University of St. Thomas in 1996 with majors in environmental studies and geography.
And tell us about your work experience, Mr. Jansen.
From 1997 to 2004, I served as an environmental scientist at Natural Resource Group. NRG is a Minneapolis-based consulting company specializing in the energy industry. In 2004, I was a founding partner at Mergent Incorporated, also a professional consulting company that specializes in the energy industry. I currently hold the position of senior analyst and corporate secretary at Mergent, providing consulting services to the pipeline and power line companies and agencies that regulate them. During the past 10 years, I've specialized in environmental regulation of oil and gas pipeline expansion and maintenance projects. Specifically, I've supported many clients with project planning and environmental scoping-related tasks, managed environmental surveys, acquired permits and approvals, prepared construction mitigation plans and contract specifications, and provided pre-construction environmental training and managed environmental inspectors and monitors out in the field. I've also served as an environmental inspector and post-construction monitor as part of various pipeline projects in Minnesota, Illinois, and Iowa, and recently served as a monitor working on behalf of the Wisconsin DNR on a large crude oil pipeline project in the state of Wisconsin.
And Mergent was hired by the commission to consult with staff on this case. Is that correct?
Yes.
State for us in general what you reviewed in preparing your pre-file testimony and preparing to testify here today.
I reviewed the Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline Construction Mitigation and Reclamation Plan. For the ease of this testimony, I'll call it the CMRP. It was prepared by Universal INSCO to assess its adequacy of mitigating impacts to environmental resources during construction. And I also assessed the measures included in the CMRP that would help ensure the project area would be restored to original productivity within a reasonable time frame along the proposed project route. Source documents I reviewed include other mitigation plans specific and not specific to the pipeline industry, including but not limited to the Keystone's application materials, U.S. Department of State EIS, or draft EIS, I guess, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission Upland Erosion Control and Revegetation and Maintenance Plan, the FERC's Wetland and Water Body Construction and Mitigation Procedures, other mitigation plans from projects similar in size and scope, and then various plans not necessarily specific to the pipeline industry but that outline best management practices for soil erosion and sedimentation control.
In addition, did you have a chance to review the burden of proof contained in SDCL 4941B22?
Yes.
You'll find marked in front of you Staff Exhibit 7. Can you identify that as your pre-filed direct testimony?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections, additions, or edits to make to that testimony?
I edited one of my recommendations in my SIR rebuttal regarding dust control. My edit is a little bit less stringent than my original in my direct testimony. Mr. Buster Gray's rebuttal of my testimony suggests that covering open body trucks or dump trucks, I guess, to control dust is not necessary because dust from open-bodied trucks is inconsequential relative to dust from agricultural operations or created by wheels on vehicles in on country roads, non-paved roads.
I agreed with Mr. Gray. He's correct that while traveling on non-paved roads, dust from open-bodied trucks or dump trucks that carry soil would likely be inconsequential. So I edited it in my sir rebuttal, and my recommended stipulation now states Keystone should cover all open-bodied trucks that can be changed to dump trucks carrying soil while in motion on paved roads to reduce fugitive dust emissions.
If you could pull your microphone a bit closer, that'd be great. Thanks.
Sure.
You did mention your sir rebuttal just now. Do you see Staff Exhibit 15 marked in front of you?
Yes.
And can you identify that as your prefiled sir rebuttal containing those changes?
Yes.
I would now like to offer Staff Exhibit 7 and 15.
Any objection?
No objection.
No objection.
No objection.
Thank you. Staffs 7 and 15 are admitted.
With those two documents now in evidence, could you give us a brief review or summary of their contents?
In my direct testimony and survey rebuttal, I generally found that the mitigation measures included in the CMRP are sufficient and, if complied with during the project, would help mitigate environmental impacts during construction, and the measures included in the plan would also help further restore the project area to pre-construction conditions effectively.
Do you have any specific recommendations to make to the commission?
I recommend that the PUC consider including my recommended stipulations from my direct testimony and sur rebuttal as part of its permit, or that Keystone choose to adopt my recommendations as part of its CMRP for the portion of the project within the state of South Dakota.
And although you stand by all of those that are submitted into record in your direct and sur rebuttal testimony, are there any particular recommendations that you'd like to highlight for the commissioners?
Well, there was one question that came up in Buster Gray's rebuttal of my direct testimony regarding topsoil segregation techniques. And really there are three different ways you can segregate topsoil. You can segregate the trench line only, segregate trench plus spoil side, and you can segregate a full right-of-way of the topsoil. And for agricultural lands in particular and hay fields, which is a greater percentage of the project area in South Dakota, I strongly urge the commission to consider requiring Keystone to employ the trench plus spoil site or full right-of-way segregation technique in agricultural lands and along hay fields. It is my recommendation, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but my recommendation is that unless the landowner specifically approves otherwise, on active croplands, residential areas, and hay fields, Keystone should be required to implement trench plus spoil side or full right-of-way segregation technique. In the plan, the CMRP, Keystone proposed to do trench line only across the entire state of South Dakota.
And your recommendation certainly wouldn't override a particular landowner request when it comes to that.
Correct. It's trumped by landowner approval. So if landowner approved trench line only, that should be granted.
I have nothing further, and Mr. Jensen's available for cross-examination.
Is it Mr. Kanicki or Mr. White? Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Jansen. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing fine.
I've got just one line of questioning. My understanding of what you just said prior to my questioning is that Keystone proposed to do topsoil stripping from the trench line only in South Dakota.
I may have. I would have to review the CMRP, but I think they. My point was they proposed to do trench line only topsoil segregation technique in agricultural areas, actively cultivated agricultural areas. And they didn't specifically say the entire across the entire state of South Dakota.
Within the CMRP?
Within the CMRP, yeah. Are you looking for the...
I'm looking for the specific reference within the CMRP.
Let's see. Let's see.
I'm looking at page 16 up at the top. You see where it says unless otherwise specified by the landowner?
Yes.
So would you take that to mean that Keystone's proposing to do what the landowner requested first and foremost?
No. First and foremost, unless otherwise specified by the landowner, the actual depth of topsoil should be stripped from the area to be excavated above the pipeline to a maximum of 12 inches.
Trench only, correct?
Correct.
Unless otherwise specified
unless
by the
otherwise
landowner.
Specified by the landowner. So the starting point there is trench line only, unless the landowner specifies that he wants a trench line plus spoil site or a full right-of-way segregation technique. What I'm proposing or my recommendation is that the starting point be trench plus spoil site or full right-of-way, unless the landowner requests that he wants trench line only.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Tobin.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi.
With regards to your recommendations in the table, are any of those in addition to or outside which would be mandated by the federal regulations or South Dakota law? Meaning, are your recommendations that you've given here dictated by what's in the CFR right now, or are some of your recommendations...
They comply with standard industry practices, and I used a compilation of different documents to form my recommendations, my findings and recommendations.
So the recommendations in here are mandated by federal regulation already?
No.
Okay, so some of these are just professional opinion based on
yes.
your recommendation of expertise
right.
and experience.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
With regard to the dust control, was there any consideration given to the seasonality of agricultural practices and the fact that dust may be heavy during certain times of the year but not others, and if those times of the year when it's not heavy because either it's not planting or harvest and they are running trucks up and down the road, was there any?
No.
Okay.
That answered your question, but mainly the dust is going to come from the wheels along the roads, and you know some dust will come from the agricultural practices as well. But you'll have a lot of heavy equipment running up and down dirt roads, and that's where most of the dust will come from.
I guess my comment would be regarding your opinion or your observation of the fact that agriculture is seasonal, in that there are heavier periods of activity in which additional dust generated by truck traffic may not be noticeable, but there are times in the year when it certainly would be noticeable. Would that be fair?
I didn't take that into account.
Okay.
Mr. Jansen, can you get a little closer to
yes.
the mic, please? Thank you.
With regard to your recommendations on the road and railroad crossings, with your specific recommendation that Keystone shall coordinate with emergency responders where project-related activities occur near roads and railroads and where road closures are necessary, is that just during construction or maintenance as well and afterwards?
It depends. If you have a large-scale maintenance project, you may want to coordinate with railroads and emergency responders as well. But that is mainly pointed at the time during construction when you're going to have hundreds of people out there.
Regarding some of your recommendations as far as obtaining additional data, I guess specifically here it's drain tiles. We've seemed to talk a lot about those today, and I'm not necessarily referring to just those. But is it part of the recommendation that that data be available to others other than just Keystone? Because I believe part of what your recommendation is that they maintain this database.
Yes.
So would that be available to others under your recommendation?
Maybe the landowner for each parcel. I think that they should maintain that on their own, and they shouldn't be obligated to share that with the public.
They should be obligated or should not be?
They should not be. That's my personal opinion.
If there could be shown value into responders or emergency personnel or to state bodies or
county. If a spill were to occur and you needed to relocate some of these drain tiles.
I'm sorry. Please don't talk.
That was my fault. I apologize.
So, Mr. Tobin, if there could be shown to value into responders or
value of the information to the responders, emergency personnel, and various local or state entities, would then your professional opinion change as to the availability of that data to other?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Could you just give me a brief, maybe explanation of your operation and maintenance recommendations regarding vegetation and I'm looking at page 5, the very last box, and the top of page 6, where you talk about the vegetation and the tree height and some of those kind of things. Could you explain that to me a little bit better?
Well, I might as well read through the finding and the recommendation. To facilitate periodic pipeline corrosion leak surveys during operation of the facilities and wetland areas, Keystone proposed to maintain a corridor centered on the pipeline of up to 30 feet in a herbaceous state. Trees within 30 feet of the pipeline greater than 15 feet in height would be selectively cut and removed from the permanent right-of-way. Standard industry practice is to maintain a corridor centered on the pipeline up to 15 feet wide and selectively cut trees greater than 15 feet in height within 15 feet of the pipeline. That's very wordy in a lot of dimensions. The bottom line is that they used a 30-foot wide corridor during the operation phase of the project, that will have they'll perform clearing activities in order to perform their corrosion leak surveys, and it standard industry practice. And this comes from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, so they set the standard, and that standard is 15 feet. So I corrected that and recommended that it be amended to comply with the standard industry practice.
So that part may be considered a federal requirement as far as the maintaining of the corridor, or is that a voluntary?
No, the FERC regulates natural gas pipelines. This is a crude oil pipeline.
Okay.
The FERC created what's called the Plan of Procedures, which is a baseline set of mitigation measures that should be implemented during construction and sometimes during the operation of facilities, which this requirement is part of. So I used that because this is a construction of a pipeline. It certainly applies to this project, but Keystone is not required to comply with the FERC plan of procedures per se, because the FERC doesn't regulate oil pipelines in this manner.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. That's all I have for now.
Questions, Mr. Hone?
Yes. Your dust containment, does that include, or your recommendation include the watering or sprinkling of roads during construction to contain dust?
I think they included that as part of their CMIP, if I remember correctly.
Okay. Your recommendation regarding the removal and then replacement of topsoil, that's based on projects you've experienced and
Yes, I've done a lot of work in Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, prime farmlands of the United States, and that's a suitable segregation technique to maintain the chemical qualities and physical qualities of the soil.
And based on your experience, that ends up with the best results overall?
Yeah. You're going to disturb more area because you need more storage for the spoil. So that's one downside of it, but keeping the topsoil segregated from the subsoil has more benefit.
The applicant's proposal would give the landowner the option, if they knew, to request something different. But if a landowner had never seen a large pipeline go through their property, they wouldn't know the difference, probably, would they?
It's a valid concern.
Thank you.
Commissioners?
On page one of your summary charts, summary tables, rather, under weed control, you make the recommendation that Keystone should obtain landowner consent in writing prior to herbicide application. Do you have any concerns about if there's an absent landowner and if there's a particularly noxious weed, and because of any one of a number of factors, there's a time-sensitive component to action?
That would be a valid concern, and that I think that does happen quite a bit.
Would you revise your recommendation to allow for some sort of a time period upon which if landowner authority couldn't be granted, action still might be taken, or just would you pass by that property? I guess my concern is with noxious weeds, you know, they don't really know the property lines.
Mm-hmm. That's a valid concern. I'm trying to put myself in the landowner's shoes, and if I lived down in Arizona for half the time and someone sprayed herbicide on my land when I was gone for 6 to 8 weeks and it wasn't my fault that I didn't respond, I may feel a little bit differently about that.
And I think your recommendation perhaps could be a little more cumbersome because the landowners need to know the specific brand name and active ingredient. I mean, if it was a one-time waiver, presumably the applicant could work hard, you know, even if it took 8 weeks or you know, a year and a half to get landowner consent. But then if there was a new product introduced or a new application method, if in each instance new landowner consent had to be obtained, that might be more difficult.
Yeah, under each instance. I think a blanket approval would be the best way to go.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Yep. And one thing to add, I mean, going into this project, you'll, in theory, be speaking to the landowners negotiating easements, and you may want to work that into your easement agreement, the ability to apply herbicide when needed or if needed.
Yeah, editorial comment, it is an odd, South Dakota landowners hate noxious weeds. They also hate anybody being on their property without permission. So
yes. Yep.
It's an interesting battle, so thanks.
Yes.
I think they hate the second far more than they hate the first, so thanks.
Yep.
I have a couple of questions for you. With respect to the topsoil segregation, and I don't know anything about it, you know, so, but your option would be to take what you believe to be a preferred practice and make that the default practice in the absence of landowner consent.
Yes.
And I'm not suggesting this, I'm just throwing it out as another possible option that raises the communication level one step at least from what TransCanada's proposed would be. Some requirement of an affirmative notification with choice of method. Is that another possibility that's slightly less, perhaps expensive or whatever for TransCanada?
So, for instance, a postcard that explains what each technique is and...
I don't know about a postcard, but something like that.
Something along that where you have a... You educate the landowner as to what the techniques are, and then you...
And their benefits and detriments.
Yes, and then they check a box and they sign at the box.
Basically, but check a box as to what they would prefer. Is that possibly another alternative, or wouldn't you believe there's enough?
It's a suitable alternative. And I don't even know that that's an alternative. I mean, that will be part of the process, I think, when Keystone goes to negotiate its easements to work out with the landowner.
With respect to the herbicide too, or pesticides or whatever it happens to be, are there any particular concerns in their use with respect to certain maybe vulnerable environments such as native prairies or any of that kind of stuff, or is it pretty much universal?
Well, I don't know about native prairies per se. I mean, you don't want to apply it. Generally, you don't want to apply herbicides within 100 feet of a water body within a wetland. You try to contain it to upland areas. I don't know about the native prairie.
And if I understood correctly, you felt another alternative to permission with respect to each particular application could be if they could do some generic noticing and opportunities for objection to, like, a sort of a more generic plan.
Well, I think if you can get a blanket approval from the – I didn't mean to step over you again.
No, go ahead.
I think if you can get a blanket approval, it's probably best for Keystone and the landowner. So they don't.
Thank you.
Yep.
Commissioner Colbeck.
Did you look into any South Dakota laws for load covers?
No.
If South Dakota has?
No, I didn't.
I think they do. The other thing is in the first page of your recommendations, you mentioned at least one environmental – I'm sorry, you mentioned at least one environmental inspector.
Yes.
In your opinion, would a employee of the DENR qualify for that?
That would qualify as a monitor. So the DENR would monitor compliance with his or other state permits that are issued.
Could you provide the commission with the job description of environmental inspector? Or qualifications of an environmental inspector?
The inspector works on behalf of Keystone to ensure compliance or help ensure compliance during construction. So he advises the contractor what he can and can't do to stay in compliance with the applicable environmental rules and regulations.
And
the monitor, the person employed by the state would just go out there and monitor that the contractor and all project personnel are complying and document that or cite noncompliance.
I guess, is it your suggestion that the PUC have someone who's very well versed in the federal laws? Are you saying that specifically the recommendations from the PUC?
Could you restate that?
This inspector that you're recommending would be an employee of the PUC. Is that what I'm understanding you to say?
No, he'd be an employee of Keystone.
Of Keystone.
Yes, or contracted by Keystone to help them ensure compliance with environmental rules and regulations.
Okay.
That's the inspector. A monitor would be employed by the state to monitor compliance.
Okay.
It's a little bit different, yeah.
That's what I needed. Thank you.
Yep.
Ms. Semler.
Just one quick clarification. There was some discussion about drain tile, the discovery thereof, and the sharing of information. Do you understand from Mr. Murdoch's or Mr. Hannon's testimony that as that information is discovered, it's incorporated into an emergency management and integrity management plan and used going forward by the company as it works with all parties involved in that process?
Yes, that would be a suitable use of that information.
Thank you.
Mr. Kennecke? Any follow-on to the commissioner questions?
Just one. On the soil segregation, would your recommendation be that if there are other facilities affected, and I'm going to use the example of a water pipeline in which they may have a vested interest in how that soil is replaced as far as for support features, as opposed to the I think the recommendation deals primarily with, and correct me if I'm wrong, does it deal primarily with landowners with either agricultural or hayland? I don't know that I saw anywhere in the recommendation where specific inclusion of narrow easement holders, for instance, if a water system has an easement for a pipeline and the soil is either going to be excavated out from underneath their pipeline to place, and I don't know that that's been determined which way that's going to work, but would your recommendation include that the existing easement holder for that line also be given some ability to dictate the replacement of that soil? And would it be appropriate?
I don't know, legally, whether or not you as a...
How about from a professional opinion standpoint?
Should you have a say on what happens to that soil and how it's handled? I think that depends on how you write your easement or how the easement agreement is written.
I'm saying if there's an existing easement across the ground, sure, and a pipeline comes along and intersects the existing
easement.
Yeah, you
have a crossover, yeah.
A crossover. So if the current easement holder, in your professional opinion, should they have be consulted as other land owners as far as the segregation and replacement of the soils during the excavation process?
If you have those rights within your easement, I think so, yes.
Thank you.
Last questions, Mr. Holm.
I have two. With regard to the weed control, the access that TransCanada is securing is an easement versus ownership. If they owned the property, it would be solely their decision as to weed control, wouldn't it?
Yes.
So the reason there's consultation with the landowner is that it's an easement access, right?
Technically, they would be performing that consultation pursuant to their easement.
Sure. And the other is a follow-up to Commissioner Colbeck's question about an inspector, a PUC-provided inspector. Would there be anything that would prohibit the PUC from having an on-site inspector?
No, the PUC should strongly consider having an on-site monitor to ensure compliance.
Thank you.
Any last commissioner questions?
I do. I think that was a misstatement of the record that the PUC wouldn't hire a consultant. All right, wouldn't hire an employee to do that, that it would be TransCanada's expense. Is that correct?
For the environmental inspector. But I think we're getting tripped up here over the difference between an environmental inspector who works on behalf of the company and a monitor who would work on behalf of you or any other state agency to ensure compliance. Did I just confuse things more? Or?
Well, I'm a little. I think I understand what you're saying, Matt. I do. I guess my question is satisfied.
Okay. I guess the bottom line is I recommend that the PUC and other state agencies look into possibly employing a monitor just to make sure that during the project, Keystone and the contractor is complying with the state rules and regulations. But at a minimum, my recommendation is that they employ one environmental inspector per spread, which is definitely industry standard at this point.
Commissioner Johnson, did you have a question? Commissioner Hansen?
No, thank you.
Ms. Semler, did you have additional follow-on?
Just a clarification of that same point. Do you have personal legal knowledge of the South Dakota PUC siting authority and whether or not it would have continued supervision responsibilities of this pipeline, or could it possibly be the responsibility of a different state or federal agency?
My answer is no. I don't know.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith, I have a couple of questions if I can ask them, please.
Go ahead.
Mr. Jansen, you were asked questions previously about an easement holder and topsoil stripping.
Yes.
Would it be your position that topsoil stripping is related to agricultural uses of property?
Yes.
And would it be related to any other uses of property that you're aware of?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Very good. I'm trying to recall, I looked briefly through your direct and sewer rebuttal testimony. Did you discuss the hiring of a monitor by the PUC anywhere within that testimony?
No.
So this is the first we're hearing about it today?
Yes.
You haven't had a chance to consider that further than what we've just done on the record now?
Correct. I was asked a personal opinion. And
very good. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I think we're done. You may step down.
Thank you.
Does that then conclude the staff's case?
That does conclude staff's case.
Is it then time to take a break?
Before we go to a break, Mr. Smith, with your indulgence, I would just let people know that the website, the internet streaming of these proceedings has been quite a hit statewide. We do track unique daily visitors, not hits, but unique daily visitors. And last week there were about 2,420 of those unique daily visitors. And my estimation would be about two-thirds of that traffic would be attributed to this proceeding. So perhaps thousands of South Dakotans are following this. So thanks.
Thank you. And why don't we take a 15-minute break? We'll reconvene. Is it 3? 10 to 3? We'll reconvene at 5 after 3.
But before we do that, the commissioners asked numerous questions of our witnesses throughout the hearing. And we attempted to and have put together a written submission. It's in the forms of exhibits TC 25, 26, and 27. We'd like to put those in through stipulation rather than call witnesses back to the stand and essentially have them be asked if that's really what they put together for the commissioners. I've distributed to the parties. I apologize, Ms. Anderson and Mr. Meckley. I did not distribute to them. I don't see them in the room. But I'd ask if 25, 26, and 27 could be admitted through stipulation. There, you asked Ms. Tilquist about what sources were consulted. The qualifications to work in the SCADA system, the Haswolper training requirements, grain carts, a basis for the assertion that pipelines are the safest way to transport crude oils. There's a big study here that, you know, it is what it is, and we'd just like to put it in the record through stipulation if possible.
Could you identify which is which in terms of the numbering of the exhibits?
Sure. 25 is the data sources used for soils and geology underlying the Keystone Pipeline in South Dakota. I'm sorry, weren't yours numbered? I apologize if they weren't. I apologize for that. 26 then starts with the TransCanada on the top, and that's 26, yep. And then 27 is this study on safety performance in the pipeline industry. And contained within there are some references to the assertions about the safety of pipelines relative to other methods of transportation. And I could refer people to those specifically if they'd care to have me do that. It is about a 30 or 40-page document.
Again, we haven't seen it at all. So, you know, does council and interveners and staff, do you need a little time to review these documents, additional time?
We've actually seen them. They're documents that staff's experts used in the process of creating their report. So I've seen them, or at least the largest document of the group, and I don't object.
I, of course, haven't seen them and haven't had the benefit, I guess, of the prior testimony. When my partner was here, I wouldn't have any objection to 25 or 26. 27, without maybe having a little better background as to what testimony took place on previous days, I'm a little bit reluctant to stipulate to that.
And which one is that? Is that the report, the thick?
That's the report that Commissioner Hansen, I believe, asked for prior in the week. I'd have to go back and look at my daily copy to see what the circumstances were.
And that was just all he was asking for is a source for her statement that pipelines were the safest form of transporting these volumes of product.
That's my recollection.
It seems like a very voluminous document to support that one.
And it sounded, statement. Based on his description, that it encompassed more than that. But you know, again, I haven't seen it, Rod, so I don't know what it says.
Well, if it can't be stipulated in the record, we'll put a witness up and have her go through it then.
Another alternative is, we could certainly put it into our public comment section. That way it would be available to Commissioner Hansen and anybody else in the universe who wanted to go to our website to look at it. Couldn't necessarily be used if the commission were to, write an order with conditions. But we do have an expert's opinion on the record that, presumably could be cited if the commission was interested in doing such. But it's just another option for you to consider.
I guess if it's satisfactory to Commissioner Hansen, he asked.
Yes, I have no objection to the method that Commissioner Johnson just suggested. As long as I have access to that, then that's great.
We'll do that then. Thanks. Thank you, Commissioner.
I wouldn't have any objection to that either. Thank you.
Wouldn't have objection if it's not entered as an exhibit in the record. If it was going to be exhibited in this this hearing, we'd want to question the author.
Well, we've allowed a mountain of stuff that hasn't been, including a number of your own documents, Mr. Hone. But we'll go that way, and that I don't think, honestly, in terms of that particular statement, my guess is that will not, the outcome of the case probably won't hinge on that statement anyway. We will do that then. Then TC exhibits. The numbers were 25 and 26 will be admitted per stipulation of the parties, and exhibit 27 will be denied, and instead TransCan will be afforded the opportunity to submit it as public comment.
And I'll do that on my way out of the building. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. At this point in time, then, in trying to recall your statement, then you had at least one witness you intended to call as a rebuttal witness.
I would call Mr. Gray to the stand, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Gray, how are you this afternoon?
Fine.
Good. I'm going to show you what I've marked as TC 20. I'll remind you, you're still under oath. Is that the first time anyone's ever had to do that to you?
Well, maybe not.
Did you happen to miss your ice storm as a result of this?
It appears that it's not in as tough in Kansas City as they thought earlier in the day.
Oh, okay.
Which is quite good.
I was about to say you got into some good weather up here.
Yes, right.
I've given you what we've marked as TC-28. Is that a document you're familiar with?
Yes, it is.
Can you tell the commissioners what that is?
It's a document that we utilize in our discussion with landowners regarding their specific tract of land. And I almost want to call it a checklist, even though it's not labeled as a checklist. But it's truly the mechanism that we utilize to try and be more specific with landowners about issues on their particular tract of land, that every tract of land is not the same and it has different uses, different improvements. And if you look at the we call it a construction restriction binding agreement, the land agents use this form in discussion with the landowners to inquire specific things on their tracts of land. And if you notice, it talks about everything from irrigation and drainage systems, existing utilities, land uses, and even on the back end of topsoil conservation and methods. This is utilized together, this information, and we call it construction restrictions. And when this is completed, and I'll try and use just an example of something here, is that let's just assume merchantable timber was on a particular landowner's tract of land, and that particular landowner wanted that timber stacked and left for his use, for his sale, for whatever he wanted to do. He would check that, and down in the comments section, he would give us instructions as to what he wanted done. This information is transferred into our construction contracts on a track-by-track basis that becomes binding to our construction contractors to perform or to honor these things that wind up in these binding agreements. So, but I think the, from our industry's perspective, our key item is we understand landowners don't know about our industry, what we do, and this is a mechanism to try, the word bothers me, but it's somewhat a mechanism to extract information from them that we're concerned about during construction because they may not know to voluntarily tell us about it. So it's completed, and the information ultimately comes back and winds up in our construction contracts, and our contractors are bound to comply with these. And typically, as long as the information's consistent or it's reasonable, we typically are not very strongly negotiate with them to take them away. If they're very, these are generally things that are pretty specific or sensitive to a landowner, and it's something that we try and comply with if we can.
I'd move TC-28 for admission.
Mr. Tobin, Mr. Hone, any objection?
Is it proper for me to ask questions now?
If you have some for purposes of objection. I think it's just being offered to show this is the document they use. But
the only question, it is to do with it. Would this document, if it's altered or amended, be supplemented and updated to the record if admitted today, meaning if it's changed before you've gone out and gotten executed copies of it?
Are you currently using this document in the field, Mr. Gray, with respect to landowners and easements?
Yes.
And in almost all cases, it'll be altered by the landowner making check marks on it and adding information to it, correct?
That's correct. It's completed, and then I believe it's on page 2. There's actually an area where you can write in things.
But you're not going to make changes as to the specific form of the document itself?
Typically not, no. But people can hand edit on to it.
No, my comments were on the pre-printed materials. If they're changed, would it then be supplemented? I mean,
yeah, we would do that if he changed it.
Okay, that's my question. Then I don't have any objection.
No objection.
Staff?
No objection.
Trans TC Exhibit 28 is admitted.
Thank you. So during easement negotiations, does the land agent discuss this with the landowner at that time?
That's correct. It's during the negotiating process.
And if you turn the page over to 2, number 10 at the top, it appears to me like the land agent discusses topsoil stripping and conservation measures. Am I right?
That's correct.
Can you tell me what ditch line means there in the third line?
That's, as we've talked about, the trench, stripping only over the trench only.
And I believe you've testified
just in the last few minutes, that this becomes a part of the contract with your, pipeline construction contractor in each and every case?
In each and every case, this document does not go in the contract, but the requirements are transferred into the contract.
As I understand your testimony, Mr. Gray, you're not in favor of stripping the topsoil from the full right-of-way?
I'm not, and you know, I've heard Mr. Jensen's testimony and I certainly respect his testimony. My experience over 30 years has been that topsoil in major agricultural areas like the Midwest is a very, very sensitive issue to the landowners themselves. I've actually experienced on many occasions because most pipeline projects or large projects have been natural gas pipeline projects under the FERC. And the FERC guidelines are just as Mr. Jackson suggests. They suggest a trench and spoil side as kind of the default unless the landowner says otherwise. But in my experience, I've had a multitude of landowners come out on the construction right away and quiz and question our construction crews about what in the world are we doing moving so much topsoil off of the right away in it. And they essentially have asked us to stop in it. So this not being an FERC process, mine was, again, the least disturbance. We request of the landowner what his preference is. We explain to him the methods and let him decide. And then we don't have a jeopardy during construction with contractors.
If I understand right, then you're advocating a default rule which leaves the most topsoil in place. Am I right?
That is correct.
And then your plan would be to go back and decompact what's been left in place after you're done?
Is topsoil is such you, when I say you decompact, but you typically just cultivate for topsoil, not don't rip. But as far as full right-of-way stripping is concerned, my personal experience has been when you take 6, 8, or 12 inches across 110 feet of construction, you are moving a mountain of topsoil. And you know, as much as we try to work with our equipment, we aren't working with teaspoons. We're working with large earth-moving equipment. And any time you handle and transfer all of this material, it's my belief you're doing more harm than good.
Thank you, Mr. Gray. Do you plan to use dust control methods near homes and businesses in construction?
I believe the construction mitigation plan, I didn't have my copy with me today, but typically in proximity to residences and businesses, we will either sprinkle or water roads to keep dust down, or sometimes I get my chemicals mixed up, but it used magnesium chloride, which is kind of a sticky tackifier, to put on roads for a few hundred feet upstream and downstream to control dust.
Mr. Gray, you heard the testimony about restoring native prairie and doing move-arounds.
I did.
Can you describe for the commission the effect those move-arounds might have on the construction process?
It's from Mr. Jensen's testimony. He'd indicated maybe being able to put this into a group of five locations or move arounds, but I have several, I guess, comments to it is that in the logistics of this assembly line that I described that moves very rapidly, the various crews in it, that the 400 or 500 workers a day, we're spending in the neighborhood of $300,000 to $400,000 a day in construction. To disrupt that operation, to move around, is extremely expensive. Secondly, the lost time and efficiency and production to stop and start extends the duration of our project. We're working into the fall and the winter here, and one of the challenges we have is to try and get our work completed and restore the right-of-way and try and get seeding done prior to winter conditions setting in, which prevents germination. So that just compounds that problem. Probably the biggest one for me personally is that it's a large number of people and equipment. When we move around, we have to load it on trucks. We have to get on the roads. We have to move around to the new spots. Causes more damage to roads. Exposes the public to more safety issues relative to hauling of these equipments. We have proven over time that we can restore native prairies and grasslands. I believe our efforts and energy should be focused on mitigation and reclamation and not moving around. And lastly for me, in my 30 years, and I've worked all over the Midwest as well as Wyoming and western states that have grasslands and prairies, I have never had to deal with a mitigation of a move around for a native prairie or grassland.
Have you been successful in your reclamation of native prairies, though?
Is Mr. Konecki, I mean, I'm in the process of building and constructing, and operation goes to someone else, but I would suggest to you over my 30 years, I've not heard a lot of things, complaints back of an inability to do that over time.
Do you know whether native grassland seeds are commercially available?
Yes, I don't know the specific species that are dealing with here in South Dakota, but many of the native species you can acquire commercially through seed companies for this restoration process. Exotic species that I've seen more in Montana and Wyoming, harvesting of those off the right of way, I have been involved with that practice, but it is my understanding that that's not the case here in South Dakota.
I've got nothing further. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Tobin, cross-examination of
Buster. I've been waiting
Mr. Gray.
My entire career to get a crack at you. I want you to know that.
Yep, and I got a 4:30 flight, Rob. Have at it. Go ahead.
With regard to native plant species, do you really have the expertise or knowledge as to whether there's sufficient commercial availability of all species that may exist in a prairie ecosystem?
No, I don't.
Okay. With regards to the soil segregation issue, my previous question, I believe, to Mr. Jansen regarding easement holders who may be in the path of the pipeline, would it be your understanding that a pipeline, a intersecting easement holder of a line may indeed have a concern about what soils are put back in position underneath their line? What I mean by that is, as opposed to the mixing of the topsoil with the subsoil, if that involved a mixing of black dirt and clay as opposed to replacing just the clay underneath their existing line, would you understand why that may be a concern of that?
I guess I wouldn't answer your question relative to topsoil, and it is that in crossing other utilities and things, our backfilling not only the soils but the techniques of how we do it. And the example I would get are we're going to take a big backhoe bucket and just dump it? No, because that might break the utility that we're crossing. So certainly the backfill materials and the techniques we use are something that we would be working with the existing utility owner as well as how we might support their utility so that we don't damage it.
But if they requested the removal and stripping of the topsoil to keep that segregated from the subsurface soils, would that be something that you'd be willing to work with them on?
I would suggest to you yes, but my thoughts are is that in dealing with topsoil separation at a utility crossing, because we typically have to make a larger excavation, that we would normally do that anyway.
Okay. Final question. Regarding soil compaction, you indicated that you cultivate the topsoil and that you don't rip necessarily. But isn't it relatively common knowledge that soil compaction by the driving of heavy equipment will extend quite deep into the soil, not just in the topsoil, but can indeed extend into the lower layers of the soil?
That's correct, and it's one of the, it is one of the more, I would suggest, in my opinion, it's probably the most significant issue we face in returning agricultural land to original productivity. But the ripping tools and things that we use are actually subsoil rippers, and in many instances we do that prior to the replacement of topsoil if we've removed it. But typically when we put the topsoil back on, we don't ripping can mix subsoil and topsoil, so we'll just till or cultivate the topsoil.
Okay, so just to make sure I understand, there will be ripping of the subsoil. It's just that you do it prior to replacement of the topsoil, and then you cultivate the topsoil after placement.
That's correct, but I would like to clarify that if we only did trench line stripping only, the ripping of the subsoil with paraplows or whatever we would do even with the topsoil on top.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Holm?
Following that line of questioning, if Mr. Jensen's, the previous witness's testimony were included, his recommendation were included, and the default was clearing the right-of-way of black dirt, piling it, working off the clay, and then putting the black dirt back. If that were done, if that were required as a condition, and the landowner had the default option or the option of saying, I want to do it a different way, you could manage that as well, couldn't you?
Mr. Holland, I want to be sure I understood the question, but when I say even if there was a fourth way besides the three I've described, I would suggest to you as long as it was reasonable, we would attempt to comply.
You, whatever the conditions are that are set, you'll need to convey something, your direction to your contractor when you bid the job. Is that right?
Is actually the project has been bid, we would be conveying it to the actual contractor that's been selected.
So whatever the final direction was to the contractor regarding topsoil, they would follow your direction.
That's correct.
Okay. Regarding TC-28, was this document gathered and secured when your agents went out and secured the easement?
It is a document that they have in their possession in their meetings prior to execution of an easement that they are to complete.
Would this information be provided to the contractor doing the digging on that land?
This information would, when I say the contractor, we have a prime contractor who does the majority of pipeline construction himself. He may subcontract a few activities, but the majority of pipeline contractors do the majority of the work themselves. So in this particular instance, all those operations would comply with the requirements off of this list.
So when you entered the landowner's property, you'd say, well, here's the agreement with this party, and here's how you have to do this work?
It's actually a section in the construction documents that's called construction restrictions, landowner construction restrictions, and the crews will have that booklet, for lack of a better word. There's a track number on this document of how we identify the landowner, and that's tied to the construction drawing. And when he crosses that property line, if there are different construction requirements, the foremen are expected to study those and implement those actions, and our inspectors have the same documents as well.
Have the agreements... this binding agreement and restrictions that you've secured, an agreement between Keystone and the landowner, has that been filed as part of this hearing record, the completed documents?
Not to my knowledge.
I'd like to draw your attention to item 6 on page 1, the soil type, where it refers to sand and clay. You see that?
Yes, I do.
Is it intended on that line that the landowner would be telling your agent what the soil makeup was, sand, clay, cobble, what their knowledge was of it?
That's correct.
And on the second page, item 12, other considerations, there's a line, the words high water table and a blank line. Is it intended that the landowner would be telling your agent how, what the water table depth was and as far as they knew?
That's correct. We're wanting the personal knowledge they have.
And in that same section, about three lines down, water wells within 150 feet and septic tanks, those would be estimated, wouldn't they? The proximity.
We're asking for a landowner if he is aware of them within that distance of our trench line or our pipeline.
The much of the testimony, or a lot of the testimony that was submitted at this hearing, referenced things like sandy soils and water sources. Might not that information have been useful to the commission in terms of knowing what landowner reaction there was or comment there was all along the pipeline route?
Would you repeat that, please?
A great deal of the questions and discussion that raised at this hearing dealt with types of soil disturbed and a depth of water table. If you've in fact surveyed a lot of the landowners as part of your easement process, your land agent process, why wouldn't that information have been useful to the commission to have during this hearing?
I don't mean this to be wrong, but I think ask the commissioners.
Okay. You might have a point there. It was, but to your knowledge, the completed surveys were not filed.
No.
Okay. And then on the last page, and this is my last question, the item 15 in the second line, second sentence there, terms, conditions, and provisions shall be binding upon heirs, executors, administrators, etc., and the agent of the parties here too. And so the owner signs and a tenant signs, and the place where it says agent, that would be your land agent for Keystone?
That is correct.
So this is an agreement as to how something's going to be done as the project crosses the land.
Correct? That's correct.
And it's binding. I'm curious, this document is signed by your agent, but the easement wasn't. Is that right?
That's correct.
Is there a reason why this would be signed and the easement wouldn't?
Well, it's certainly I'm not legal counsel as far as it goes, but the easement is a recorded instrument that stays of record at the courthouse for the posterity of the land, as far as that goes. And it's my understanding that that binds the company in that recording of that contract. This is not recorded at the courthouse. It is an agreement between two parties. And for it to be valid, my understanding is that it needs to be bound to like a contract.
Thank you.
Ms. Sammler?
I do have one question. Mr. Gray, in your preferred trenching method, as I understand it, subsoil removed from the trenching area will sit on top of some topsoil on the spoil side. Is that what it's called?
That's correct.
Is there a method that you use to prevent a mixing of that topsoil and the subsoil removed from the trench line?
In the particular method called the trench line only, the spoil would sit on top of the topsoil. And generally with vegetation or something that's there, it gives a visual demarcation that when you're pulling the subsoil back in, it gives you a visual for the operators to be able to distinguish that. In some instances, we take hay or something like that to scatter across the top of the ground to better distinguish it as well.
In cultivated ag land where there wouldn't be that vegetative barrier, is that when you would use the straw or hay, or is there another method you use in that area?
That's correct. That's where you would use something to like hay or straw or mulch that would give you a distinguishing barrier, for lack of a better word.
Thank you. Thank you. Nothing further.
Commissioner?
I just have a couple of really quick questions. In number six, as Mr. Hone had brought up, the soil type, does that in any way preempt the HCAs or anything like that, or anything that you find on a federal or from DENR, or is this an augmentation to that?
I don't see any relationship of this to HCAs or anything. This is more of constructability type issues.
If they say it's sand, it's kind of a guess on their part.
You know, we found that landowners are very knowledgeable, and for me, with this information, it helps us in determining the types of equipment we might use, whether the wheel trenchers or the backhoes. It just makes us smarter prior to opening up the ditch.
Okay. But this in no way trumps any federal requirements or anything like
that? No, sir. Okay. Not at all.
There's a lot of stuff on here. Is this something that they basically say they want, or is this brought back to you and then determined to be reasonable?
Is what this typically will do is it will prompt a landowner to think about things that our construction might do. I would suggest to you there are many landowners that other than just filling it out, there'll be nothing on it. But it's our ability to you know, one about access. We've heard that mentioned several times with cattle, that a landowner can say on here, I have cattle in the field. I need them to be able to move back and forth. I need some lanes kept open during construction to allow that, and it gives them a vehicle to get that information to us.
Okay. And were the landowners that were here, were they approached with this after they were here?
You know, I would defer to those landowners, but some of the landowners or a large group that have been present in our hearings simply will not communicate with us. So they may not have seen this form to date.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Gray, my recollection of the Commission's public comment meetings during the summer is that this document was discussed a number of times. Is that your recollection as well?
I do recollect it. I don't know if it was ever handed out or presented, but I do believe it was discussed.
Do you know if Webb Water ever requested these completed documents via the discovery process?
Not to my knowledge.
Do you know if Mr. Hone, as a pro se intervener, ever requested these completed documents as a part of the discovery process?
I don't know what a pro se intervener
is. Mr. Hone, as an individual.
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
No.
I didn't know until last year, so.
So I shouldn't feel bad.
Commissioner's done. Redirect. You're excused, Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
You better head for the airport.
You'll get another shot at me.
Mr. Kaneki?
We have nothing further, Mr. Smith.
I believe that, unless commissioners, do you have any additional requests? Otherwise, no, that's my stuff. I think that concludes the evidentiary part of the hearing. Is there any final comments or whatever from any of the parties? Mr. Hone?
Has the HCA map been submitted and reviewed here as evidence?
It is in evidence, is my recollection. I think it is, as part of exhibit. Well, I can't remember.
C.
Exhibit, well, I think it was 1C. So it is in evidence, yes.
So if I were to look at document 1C in the table, would I see that map?
I cannot tell you what's on the table.
You would not. The portion of 1C that's been kept confidential is found in a box that Mrs. Axelm's been patiently delivering up and down the steps for the pendency of the proceeding.
It is in evidence.
But it is in evidence. It was listed on the sheet that we put in the first day, the stipulation from the admission, but that hasn't been set out on the table for public review because not everybody has signed the confidentiality agreement. But you've signed it, and you've looked at the stuff, and it's part of the record. It's been stipulated in evidence.
So let me see if I understand. It is something that could be reviewed and discussed at this hearing, provided the parties that were discussing it had signed the agreement of confidentiality?
Yes. I mean, that could have been done at any time.
Well, this...
With respect to the people who, you know, and this has been explained since day one with respect to confidential stuff, it's with respect to things that are under seal, that they've got to be dealt with what we call in camera, with persons who are not subject to the confidentiality provisions, not present.
So if I were to ask to see the HCA map and have it reviewed at this hearing, is that acceptable to the hearings officer?
Well, I mean, right now, I guess, Mr. Hone, we'll have to hear from the other parties. From a procedural standpoint, again, you're not a lawyer, and I understand that. I mean, your case is basically over at this point in time. But I guess I'm not sure what you're getting at. You've signed the agreement, so yes, you have the right to look at it.
And Mr. Smith, I guess a question I might have for you to consider on your ruling, or Mr. Hone, just so you can help us understand a little bit better what you're looking at. I mean, the maps are what they are. I mean, they may be missing a particular location, and that would certainly be something that the applicant, if this were approved, would be required to endeavor to get the most accurate information. I'm not sure what a determination by an individual commissioner that, yes, indeed, an HCA might have been omitted by the federal government, I'm not sure how that helps us in making a determination.
Well, I don't know. What are you looking for? And then we'll hear what the other parties have to say.
Well, it's a very confidential document. And when I signed the statement, I took it literally as to what I could say or not say about it. So I don't want to – if I start saying something I'm not supposed to, I assume you will cut me off.
It's just specific locations that are on that map are where we get into the confidentiality.
Sure.
That are
I won't get into specific locations, but
and if we can go there, but then we have to remove persons who have not.
I don't think the question I want to raise at this point would require that. When I did look at the map. John Smith and your staff were kind enough to help me see that, allow me to view it, and I signed the agreement. And I didn't get a copy of what I signed, but I remember that it was fairly serious that I signed. And
I actually did give you a copy, Kurt.
I guess
you might have forgotten about it. It's just that little thing. It's the addendum to,
yes.
The protective order.
Well, going on then, I have questions as to what's on the map. I mean, when I look at the map and I read maps as part of my job, but I don't claim to know what everybody's map means. That's the first item. The second item is, and it goes to what you're saying, Mr. Johnson, is the adequacy. And the thing that when I saw the map, the thing that came to mind was, is that all that is significant in South Dakota? It looked like it was lacking. But it's hard to assess that without having somebody that would also maybe address what is there. It didn't look like there was much there. And that's, I don't want to delay this hearing. I'd like to get home, and I have further to drive than some of you. So I don't want to delay it any longer than necessary. But I would assume the commissioners will look at the map. If they haven't, they probably will. But looking at it without getting into the detail, it just looked to me like it was kind of scant.
Mr. Smith, if we could comment.
Please do.
We presented a witness, Ms. Heidi Tilquist, with respect to the HCA maps. She testified for an extensive period of time. She was cross-examined twice by Webb, once by Mr. Rasmussen, once by Mr. Hone. There were many other witnesses who appeared and discussed the HCAs. Never at any time during any of that testimony did Mr. Hone make his request to present the maps, clear the room, have an in-camera session. It just seems like it's way late to be raising this issue now after those witnesses have been up and down. In fact, some of them have already headed home.
Mr. Tobin, did you want to weigh in at all? And you haven't been here during all of that, so you probably don't know what they said. But
right. I guess I would be at this point in time inclined to not oppose what Mr. Hone is proposing.
Mr. Smith, why don't I respond?
I think staff has an opportunity. I just think Mr. Hone had his opportunity to put on his case, just as we all did. And if we are going to open up this hearing and start all over again, then we're all going to start all over again. And that will serve no purpose. We all had a chance to put on our case. And I find the request, although we don't quite know what he's requesting, I find it procedurally inappropriate.
I might point out one thing, Mr. Hone, and I don't know what the commissioners are going to do now at the close of the evidentiary portion of the hearing. This still doesn't end things as in the normal course of major cases like this. The next phase of this then will probably be that the commission will, and the parties may, request the opportunity to submit briefs. And may also elect, and we usually, with big cases like this, we kind of like the parties, if they want to submit proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. And at the end of that is oral argument. Now, we've had an enormous amount of discussion and evidence presented from everybody, from individual landowners to hydrology experts, hydrology exhibits. Several of those were your own exhibits that probably give us probably as much of the base evidence that we're going to have in this, and maybe an appropriate avenue for you to make your points in lieu of today, again, like they said, because of the usual order of a case, their witnesses have gone. If we're at the point where what you're trying to do is take evidence that exists now in the record and then make arguments about the adequacy or inadequacy of the HCA maps, perhaps another avenue for doing that might be via your final briefing and oral argument based on the evidence we have in the record today, which is extensive on everything from Mr. Wade's testimony, your own testimony about Webb's intentions, the geological maps, Mrs. Anderson's testimony about the depth of her wells, testimony of now I can't remember her name, Brenda Winkler, testifying about the certain potential for interconnection between some of those aquifer areas. We have a lot of that stuff in the record, and maybe you're at the point where what the avenue might be argument related to what that evidence should show and what the commission maybe should do, rather than additional evidence per se. Is that a fair? Do you understand my point?
I do, and I appreciate your summary. Two things I'd like to say. First of all, Mr. White lecturing me on not bringing this up sooner. You know, it's his evidence, and it's not sitting on the table, with all due respect. The second thing is, it apparently is quite material, because every time we turn around, HCA is raised. And I'd just like to, I'll leave it, I'll take your under advisement, which you suggested, and pursue that. But I want to say that I come from a city where Mr. Baum wrote The Wizard of Oz, and there's a small man behind the curtain, and I would represent that HCA is a small man behind a curtain with a very large microphone. Thank you.
Could you explain?
Is that appropriate? I don't get it.
I'll send you the book.
I know all about The Wizard of Oz, and I don't like the innuendo. So I was wondering if you could explain.
Maybe I'll just add this. I mean, I think the applicant and staff have raised some very valid concerns about procedure, and I do think Mr. Smith has been, you know, quite liberal in his willingness to allow in evidence or questions to try to fill out the record, even if perhaps it didn't follow the strictest procedure. And, you know, Mr. Hone, if you had something specific and material, I could see it more likely that the commission would adopt, a similar approach. To me, if we're just, because right now we already have on the record that this proposed pipeline would be in the general vicinity of wetlands and community water system lines and shallow aquifers and cultural resources and environmental resources. if what you're seeking to do is just to have a further examination of those same issues, I, on a personal level, don't think that that would add to the record. Now, if you have something very specific, a substantial and significant resource that could be endangered by the pipeline that we have not yet addressed in the last 7 days, then I think at least I would be more willing to take some time to evaluate that. But I haven't heard that that's the case.
Could I respond, Commissioner? I don't feel I can speak to it given the confidentiality document I signed. I don't believe I can, given that document and saying you're not allowed to talk about the HCA report because of the federal designation. So,
well, Mr. Smith has told me that we can talk as much as we want about stuff that's not on there. Now, your counsel, or you may counsel yourself, that you would have a different interpretation of that. But if there's something big and important that's not on that map that should be, I think we can talk about that, and I'm, until Mr. Smith or somebody else tells me otherwise, I don't even know that we necessarily would need to go into an in-camera session to do that. I mean, what is it we're really nervous is out there that we haven't talked about at all?
Well, and following that guidance, I'll just say these two things. I do not see on that map, I'm speaking to what I don't see, not what I saw. I don't see some of the very specific, significant resources that are in that area that would be impacted addressed. And I think what TransCanada has done is limited it to within 1 mile, which we've had testimony that says it could be wider than that. That's one issue. The other is I saw no reference, unless I'm reading the map wrong, and I could be reading the map wrong but it has a legend, and you try to follow the legend. If the attempt by the Department of Transportation was to protect oil and gas pipelines, I'm not sure I saw them on the map, for example. So I'll leave it at that. I appreciate your response, and I'm not trying to be difficult. I think what we will do, and I've discussed this with Mr. Rasmussen, and we will pursue the suggestion Mr. Smith mentioned and follow that area. But I guess for what it's worth, as a commission looks at that, I think you might want to ask that question. Is everything there that should be, in your opinion? And I think, given all the confidentiality related to that at a national level, for whatever reason, it's the one thing that never got presented here today without restriction, or this week. And so it confuses me. I've never been involved in something where that's done. And I doubt that you've ever, maybe you have, I don't know, and maybe that's common, but has a commission ever had a situation where you were not able to look at the exhibit? So that's a question, and I guess what we will do is follow Mr. Smith's advice and take the next step available.
And just as a clarification, I think it is incredibly routine in large hearings like this, and granted my sample size in only 3 years on the commission is relatively small, but I can't remember a multi-day hearing where we didn't deal with confidential exhibits. What we did do is during the normal process of offering evidence, people introduced the evidence, they asked for the room to be cleared, such was done, and we dealt with the information. And this is not secret information. People can look at it. They just have to sign it, and the commissioners have had access to it, and so have, to my knowledge, all of the parties who are willing to sign that. So it's very routine for the commission to deal with that kind of information.
And I would want to clarify, too, just for anybody listening in out there, that it isn't the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission that is elected to have this document have that status. It's not even the applicant, TransCanada.
Thank you for saying that, Mr. Smith. That's important.
It is the United States Department of Transportation, and, you know, I certainly trust everything the United States government does, but unfortunately, it's not something that, whether they're right or wrong, I don't know that it's something we can do anything about, and it's just the way it is in this day and age, at least for a while, till I think there will come a time here in 3 or 4 or 5 more years when we come back to our senses after some of this stuff. But as of right now, I don't think we can do anything about it. I wish we could, but unfortunately we can't. But on the other hand, I do want to clarify, the HCA maps are in the record. They are in the record as a confidential exhibit, and therefore they weren't made up, put up there where everybody can see them. You can look at them. Your lawyers can look at them. anytime you want to, subject to the restrictions and protective order. You can make argument, and again, if there's evidence related to the HCA maps that should be introduced that hasn't been, it probably should be, but by all means, we've introduced, there's just been a mountain of stuff. I mean, we've heard a huge amount of material on the presence of the drainage ditches along the way, of water courses, of wetlands, Renzenhauer Slough and its outlet then into Sand Lake and the James River and all of those things, that the existence and the placement of BDM's rural water intakes, the City of Britain, and on and on and on and on and on. And I think right now that's evidence. Those things are where they are, and there's evidence of that. I think we might be right now at the point where it's not really evidence, and the HCA maps are what they are. It might now be arguing about whether or not the HC map should contain things that we've heard evidence about, and it doesn't. And that may be argument, not evidence, if that makes sense. And I would say this, too. I mean, you're a party to the case, and Webb is as well. And if there comes a point where we realize that there's additional material evidence that we should have heard and didn't hear, parties to the case have the ability to make a motion to reopen this proceeding, and we can entertain that if there's a viable reason for doing that, if there's a material reason for doing that. I just think right now, I think the point that the applicant's made, and it's not a bad point, is given the normal flow of evidence in a case, they've now believed the case was over following their rebuttal from an evidence standpoint, and that they've let their witnesses leave. So it's kind of prejudicial to them to attempt to cross-examine people that aren't here, I guess is the bottom line on that. Is that a fair statement? Again, I want to leave open the fact that you're a party, and if you believe there's evidence that hasn't been admitted that should be, by all means, you have the right to make a motion to that effect.
Well, Mr. Smith, I agree with much of what you just said. I'd like to clarify, I'm not in any way saying that the commission has in any way placed a restriction on HCA. The way it was presented, it was a federal restriction. And so you've dealt with that. What I'm saying is, and I can't get to the specifics, but it looks like that map is very limited, and maybe that's another arena that needs to be addressed. I would state, I guess, for the record, that that exhibit, we have serious reservations about it based on reviewing it, and reserve a right to pursue that and whatever avenues are remaining. I guess I was under the impression that at some point the room may be closed and they would present it, and maybe that was a mistake on my part. But I don't want to delay the hearing any longer. I just want to make that statement for the record.
Okay, and I appreciate that. And again, by all means, I could be wrong, but we've gone through so much stuff. It'll be surprising to me if there's actual factual evidence, and you can argue. I would caution everyone who's going to make arguments involving any confidential exhibit that those portions of briefs ought to be, that discuss the confidential stuff ought to probably, those should be segregated into the confidential portion of briefs. And I might make one other comment too, and that is, you know, there is an ongoing PHMSA permitting proceeding, you know, a DOT proceeding at the federal level, and certainly you as an individual and Webb, you certainly have the ability and the right to express your thoughts to at those agencies as well, because in the end they are the actual they're the actual decision makers with respect to that. So with that, pardon me, Mr. White.
I apologize, and I don't want to belabor this, but I don't want to leave the impression in the room that Webb or Mr. Hone was in any way precluded from making an evidentiary presentation at this portion of the hearing with respect to the HCA maps. He reviewed the maps. He produced a number of witnesses. There was a vehicle available to present testimony on those issues in an in-camera session. He was represented by sophisticated counsel. He had every opportunity over the last 7 days to present that testimony and chose not to. That was a deliberate choice on their part, and I don't want the room or the Internet to reflect the suggestion that he was in any way precluded from doing that. That was a decision that he made.
With that, I think all parties have had a chance to weigh in on this. We've left open the opportunity for parties to make subsequent motions and to present arguments and briefs regarding the evidence or prejudice that may have occurred and they think may have occurred in the case. And with that, at this point in time, would the parties want to, and the commission, and we're all getting tired, I'm sure, after many days of this, do you want to discuss post-hearing procedure right now and get some feeling for that right now so we all know where we're going?
Yes, we're all here.
Okay. With that, I might start this time with let's see what the parties have to say first in terms of, I'll just tell you what we usually would do, would be to first establish a briefing schedule. And that takes various forms, depending upon what the parties, how they wish to proceed on it. That usually also includes, at some point, the submission of proposed findings and conclusions. And then at the very end of that process, we usually entertain oral argument. With that very general structure, maybe we'll start with the applicant and get your thoughts on what we ought to do in terms of a post-hearing schedule.
We'd propose 30 days for simultaneous briefs, 15 days for simultaneous reply briefs, and oral argument at the commissioner's option. Let them decide whether they think there's something in the briefs that they want to hear more about or ask about, but I wouldn't propose that anybody be entitled to oral argument as of right. Let the commissioners decide that. That would be our proposal. And we will submit proposed findings and conclusions. I don't care if the other parties, they can do that at their own option, but we certainly intend to submit those.
And you say 30 days, and then how much for the reply was your suggestion?
15.
Mr. Tobin.
Mr. Smith. It may be nice to have a little additional time. If the commission chooses not to allow it on the initial briefs, we would certainly appreciate it on the reply briefs. I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of information to sift through in the initial round of briefing. So I'm not saying the time frames are unworkable, but if additional time can be given, I would appreciate it on the reply brief side of it.
Do you have separate comments from that, Mr. Holmes?
No, I don't. I defer to counsel.
Okay. Ms. Semler?
Staff finds applicant's recommendation workable. So.
Okay.
Mr. Tobin, you wanted additional time for the reply round. Did you have anything in particular in mind?
You know, if we could get 20 days, that would probably be helpful as opposed to 15.
You know, my thought would be this commission always likes to leave a little bit of room at the back end. I mean, if for some reason we were to find that after receiving the briefs that additional information was needed or witnesses or that the application is submitted was not sufficient to make a ruling. Boy, we'd sure want a little time to be able to do that. But, of course, 15 to 20 days is not – you're not suggesting a huge difference.
No, I'm just suggesting that we may need an additional week in there to try and – we don't have as many rows of people as they do, so.
Mr. Holmes.
Just a question as to transcript schedule. Do you have any idea on that?
Well, that we got to address to Sherry Whitler, our reporter. Sherry, what's your prognosis? I wasn't talking your personal prognosis. Sure.
It normally takes 2.5 times the amount of time that the proceeding was to prepare a transcript. So
before the baby or after?
Yeah, this will be done before the baby for sure. I mean, I would say that I will need 3 weeks. Does that really mess with the schedule?
Given the availability, you've emailed both the WebWater and our site every night with rough drafts of the transcripts. I don't think it messes with the schedule at all.
Are you saying the 3 weeks, or are you saying we should be operating off of draft?
That's exactly what I'm saying. You can go back and look at the parts of the draft about which you've got questions, but the overwhelming majority of what you and we have gotten every night is substantially useful.
We've been told not to rely on that. I'd like to see the transcript. I think that's normal procedure, isn't it?
Excuse me. May I just interrupt for one moment? I guess given the fact that I've already done a little work on the rough drafts every night, I would say 2 weeks would be a better estimate. I know that's not real quick, but, I mean, given the fact that we have 7 days worth of transcripts, it's going to be about 1,700 pages. It'll take 2 weeks. My normal turnaround is 1 week for just a day or two.
You know, my thought would be that we could set 30 days, and if for some reason there was a very, I mean, understandable delay that required the commission pushing the reply, the initial brief deadline back, I would certainly think we'd be open to that. We're not looking to turn you into an indentured servant. Just so for everybody's knowledge, January 15th is a Monday, which would be 33 days, 33 or 34 days. I don't know whether December's got 31 days, but I don't know if you count a day or not. It's a holiday. So if we go the 16th of January, that would leave.
January 15th is a Tuesday on my calendar.
I'm looking at 2007, so I'm wrong, Dave.
I'm looking at 2008.
No, that's why you're right. So January 11th is a Friday, January 15th is a Tuesday.
The applicant would ask that the date set be January 11th.
I think the 15th is appropriate.
Well, my suggestion for what it would be worth, Mr. Smith and commissioners, would be that maybe we give a little more time on the front end, and then we don't need to necessarily push all the way back to 20 on the reply. Or do you want to go to the 11th and get your 20? I'm trying to split the baby here. Do you want more in the first round or more in the second round?
More in the second.
More in the second. So that would give us January 11th, 2 weeks. Then we could go January 28th, would give 17 days. 18 would be 29th. 19 days would be 30th. 20 days would be the 31st. So for discussion's sake, Mr. Smith, I'd throw out the dates of January 11th and January 31st.
Well, I think, you know, again, parties have comments on that.
We stand by our original proposal. It's sufficient amount of time.
Mr. Tobin.
and we stand by ours.
I say it's time. Pardon me? Ms. Samler.
I can get emails of all those transcripts, correct? I don't have those. If I can get copies of the transcripts everyone else will be working off, I can work it.
Okay, well, I heard a suggestion from the chairman. I think we're at the point where commissioners, this is one where we're no longer in the hearing, evidentiary hearing mode. I think it's your decision to make. Do you want to make a motion and vote?
Commissioners, I would move that the deadline for initial simultaneous briefs be January 11th, which is Friday. It's in 2008. And that the deadline simultaneous reply briefs be due on January 31st, which is a Thursday in 2008. Motion has been made. No second is required. We'll proceed to discussion on the proposed agenda.
I have one discussion item to bring up before you guys begin. With respect to proposed findings, would it be the pleasure of the commission? Would you prefer to see those in the first round or the second round in connection with?
My thought would be first. Certainly, if they need to make amendments in the reply brief, if they feel they've messed something up, they could certainly.
Well, the other thought I have is then it would allow the reply brief to address argument, you know, to make argument regarding proposed findings. Any discussion?
It's acceptable.
I'd agree.
Yes.
Would you, Mr. Chairman, would you care to add that to your motion?
I think that's good. We'll certainly, unless there's any objection, we'll amend the motion to require that proposed findings and recommendations to those parties that are going to offer them need to be made by the 11th, and those that make proposed findings and recommendations on the 11th would be able to offer minor revisions on their reply brief if they felt it was necessary. Discussion.
I'm sorry. Can I ask one question at this time, Commissioner?
Yeah. Since this is an iterative process, we could certainly anybody can make a comment.
The oral argument portion of it, I understand applicant's position on it. I guess we're inclined at this point in time to let it be the commission discretion as well. However, I think it would be our preference to present oral argument if given any consideration to that.
Yeah, we could certainly add to the motion that the commissioners, could at anyone's option. They could request that by a motion of the commission. I don't know until I see the briefs at this point. I don't know that I'm dying for oral argument, but it may be that issues are raised in the briefs that are going to require some legal questions, and I'll need to hear what the attorneys have to say about it. But, I mean, and the attorneys want to correct me, but to my understanding, an oral argument would essentially, I mean, that we're really going to want to examine the legal issues because we're not going to be uncovering new evidence in an oral argument, so... Any further discussion, questions, or concerns on the proposed motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Mr. Smith, we'll pass it back out over to you.
Unless there are any final matters to bring before the commission, we will stand adjourned.
This is a good time to get this work done because, normally, if it's two parties, they can kind of agree to stuff on, in the interim. But because we have 170 parties, sometimes an open meeting like this is a good time to get business done. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have anything else to?
No, we have nothing further to discuss. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, I'd just like to compliment your staff for the great coffee service. They've been well cared for you. Thank you.
and thank everyone who's been patient through this whole proceeding. It's been an emotional proceeding, and I thank everyone for their hanging in there and for civility. And again, we stand adjourned.
As long as we're doing thank yous, I do think the staff that we haven't seen much of today but has been really working very hard to get information that's filed in this docket up as soon as possible so it can be made available to parties. There's been some instances where that's been quite a burden to them personally, working late nights. Thank you to them. And Mr. Smith, unfortunately, has had the misfortune of having me in his left ear as he's been running this hearing. And I've sometimes been overly critical in your left ear from time to time, so my apologies for that. And I think my colleagues and I would agree you've done a fine job.
Well, no apology needed, and to the extent it was needed, it's accepted. The hearing is adjourned.